I want to take up in November the 12th, 1921. Sanctity in the divine will has no boundaries, and it's the closest to its creator, and will have the primacy over all other sanctities. So here we have a very important message. Louisa said, I write only to obey. Otherwise, I would not be good at marking down a single word. Only the fear that I might sadden my sweet Jesus if I don't do it gives me the stamina and the strength. Now, he continues to speak to me about his most holy will, and upon coming, he said, my daughter, the sanctity in my will is not yet known. How could it be? He's only beginning to explain it. This is the reason for their surprise. They are the priests, okay, who are guiding Louisa. And of course, representing the church as well. In fact, when something has been known, the surprise stops. All sanctities are symbolized by something which is spread in the Creator. In other words, all sanctities represent something of God and something of what he has done. There are sanctities symbolized by mountains, others by trees, others by plants, others by the little flower. If you take St. Therese of Lisieux, she said she was the little flower. Others by stars. If you take Daniel chapter 12, verses 1 to 2, he says that the good people who try to do God's will shine like stars for all eternity. We know that throughout the Bible, trees represent the people of God. Okay, so those committed to God. So all of these sanctities have their own limited and individual good. They have their beginning and they have their end. They cannot embrace everything, because how could the little flower embrace all the stars and the galaxies, for example? They can't embrace everything because they represent one thing. And Therese said she represented childhood. That was what she wanted to portray to the church, Matthew 18, that we should become like little children. So she was representing one thing. So they couldn't embrace everything. Now, Jesus said, the sanctity in my will be symbolized by the Son. Now, up to this moment, the Son with a capital, the Son, I shouldn't say with a capital anything, the Son has been used as a symbol of the divine will. The Son has been spoken about as the source of life and light and fecundity upon the earth. And it's even been used with a capital S as a symbol of the divine will. Now we're being told that the sanctity in the divine will is symbolized by the Son. Now, before we even move on, we know that the Son lives high up. It's 93 million miles away from the earth, that its beams affect the entire earth, so therefore it does good to all. It's completely universal in its giftedness. It doesn't give or take according to the goodness or the badness of any particular area. It gives all its gifts just straight up. So he said, the sanctity in my will be symbolized by the Son. The Son has always been and will always be. Now, because the Son was there before humanity. So as far as we're concerned, it has always been there and will always be there until the end of the world, the end of time. And even though it did have a beginning in illuminating the world, because its beginning is in Genesis chapter 1, let there be light. Vehi or et vehi or, let there be light, and there was light. So it had a beginning. Since it is light, which takes its origin from the eternal light. So the eternity of the Son is the fact that it takes its light from the one who is light. One can say, because of that, one can say it has no beginning because God has no beginning or no ending. The Son does good to everyone. It extends its light to everyone. It makes no exception. That's the way God works as well. Jesus said that God lets his sun to shine on the good and bad alike, and his rain to fall on the good and bad alike as well. So it makes no exception for anyone. And therefore, the sanctity in the divine will has to be a love without borders. And it has to be a holiness without borders. With its majesty and dominion, the sun rules over everything and gives life to everything, even to the tiniest flower. But he does it silently, because that's the way light works. And that's the way God works as well. He does things silently, without noise and almost unobserved. Oh, if a plant did a little something, a shadow of what the sun does, giving heat to another plant, all would shout, miracle. Because we know a plant can't do it. All would want to see it and would speak about it with utter amazement. But then the sun gives life and heat to everything and is in the continuous miracle, and nobody talks about it and there's no amazement. We just take it for granted. This happens because man keeps his eyes always down below and on earthly things and never up high and on celestial things. Now, this is very important. Where is your focus? If the focus is on earthly things, you are not going to understand the things of God. That is in 1 Corinthians, and it's in chapter 1, the second half of the chapter, where the unspiritual, they can't see anything and they can't accomplish anything. But the spiritual, the ones who are open to God and the Spirit, yes, they see and they understand. So it's because human beings keep their eyes on the wrong level. They're looking down to the earth for everything and they don't keep them on high with their focus on celestial things. Now, in the sanctity of my will, Jesus said, symbolized by the sun, this sanctity will come out from the center of my own sanctity. Now, you need a VIP on that one. It is divine, and therefore it is absolute holiness. It will be a ray delivered by my sanctity, and therefore, of course, naturally, the greatest of all sanctities. It has no beginning, and therefore these souls existed in my sanctity. They exist and they will exist. Now, there's your single point, the singularity of the divine will. It has always been, is, and always will be. When God was asked by Moses, "What is your name?" he said, "I am." I am has no beginning and it has no ending. So for those who choose to enter into the divine will sanctity, it means that that choice of theirs, which of course corresponds to the choice of the Lord calling them into it, that was an eternal choice. Everything in God is an eternal choice. There's no surprises for him. Just think about it. Therefore, these souls existed in my sanctity. They exist in the present and they will exist. There's your past, present and future. Isn't that something to think about? They were together with me in the good that I did. They never went out of the ray in which I had issued them to the light. So, if we are living in the divine will, and the divine will accomplished great miracles in the life of Jesus, we were there. Our yes was there. Our fiat was there. When he preached the gospel, our fiat was there. When he agonized in Gethsemane, our fiat was there. And you see this with Louisa in the Hours of the Passion, that Jesus lets her know she's actually there. It's not just there in prayer. She's actually there. They were together with me in the good that I did. They never went out of the ray in which I issued them to the light. Since they never departed from my will, I enjoy myself with them, and I still do. That is Proverbs 8:31. The Lord delights to be with the children of men, as a parent delights to be with his children as well. My union with them is permanent. So you can see that our surrendering to the divine will is an eternal commitment. It is without ending. It has a beginning because it depends on our decision, but it has no ending. My union with them is permanent. I see them floating over everything. Human supports do not exist for them. We're not actually looking to humans for anything. We're going directly to the Lord. And therefore, you have Deuteronomy 32:12. The Lord alone is their guide. Human supports do not exist for them, just as the sun does not lean on anything. It lives up high as though isolated, but with its light it encloses everything within itself. So the souls living in the divine will are not looking to the earth for anything because they receive everything from God. And yet the whole earth benefits from their relationship with God. They are giving to the earth, but the earth is not giving to them. It is the same with these souls. They live up high. So there's the spiritual eagles. Okay. They live up high like the sun, but their light descends to the deepest bottom and extends to all. So there's the love without borders. And the way that souls are saved by people in the divine will, living the hidden life of Nazareth. I would feel as if I defrauded them if I did not keep them aware of and did not let them know do what I do. So because we live in the divine will, he allows us to participate in everything. Therefore, there's no good which does not descend from them. That is the shocking conclusion that Jesus brings. There's no good. Notice the no good which does not descend from them. So here you have an extraordinary image of God like a great sun, and the rays of this sun go out and give life to absolutely everything. And then we enter into that sun and become one with it. So we are in those rays that go out giving life to everything. But if you say we two are one, you have to add, but he is the one. There is no good which does not descend from them. In my sanctity, Jesus said, in this sanctity, I see my shadows, my images. That's Romans 8:29. In this sanctity, I see my shadows, my images hovering over the whole earth. I see them in the air and in the heavens. This is why I love and will love the world. It's because of these authentic children. That's Romans 8:19. Romans 8:19. These authentic children of God, living completely for him, abandoned to him, and cooperating with him in everything that he does. And it's because of this small number of real children that he is prepared to be indulgent with the rest. This is why I love and will love the world, because I am waiting for my sanctity to have its echo over the earth. And you see, we give that echo. And I'm waiting for my rays to come out to the light, to give me complete glory, returning to me the love and the honour which the others have not given to me. So we give him the honour and glory and love and thanksgiving and worship and everything else in the name of all, in substitution for all who do not give it to him. However, just like the sun, they will be the most unobserved without clamour. That's very important. You see, if God gave you a healing ministry, it would be very obvious. you'd be out there, you'd have the crowds absolutely running after you. There would be great meetings and hullabaloo and noise and everything else, and you'd get both persecution and great praise and honour and all the rest of it. It's all out there. The lights and the bells ringing, the lights shining and the bells ringing and all the rest of it. But the sanctity, the spirituality of the divine will is completely the opposite to that. Our Blessed Lady was the first, after Adam, of course. She lived completely unobtrusively. The people in Nazareth probably only thought she was a nice lady and that she was friendly and that she was no trouble. I remember being utterly amazed at a person in whose dwelling I spent some time during my labours around the world, and the person saying to me, "But you're no trouble at all." And at the time, I didn't appreciate what was actually being said. But somebody living this interiority is no trouble to anybody else, because you're not making any demands. You're not looking for anything from them. You're not looking for advantages for yourself. You're not putting them out. You're there to give. You're there to be a light for others. You're not there to receive. And so Jesus said, like the sun, these souls will be the most unobserved, without clamour at all. In fact, some of these saints are not even recognised in the house they actually live in. Their immediate family don't recognise them, let alone anybody else. And if anyone wants to look at them, my jealousy will be such that they will run the risk of remaining blinded and will be forced to lower their eyes in order to regain their sight. In other words, the Lord won't allow the mystery that is operating within you to be observed by anybody else. He did not allow anyone to observe it in our Blessed Mother's life, not until after the resurrection, when John took care of her and she began to reveal herself to him. Do you see how beautiful the sanctity of my will is? It is the sanctity closest to your Creator. Isn't God the most unobserved person in the universe? Isn't he the one who has no clamour? He's not looking for anything. He's giving all the time. He's giving all the time. And his love is without borders. People or groups that we might think is outside of his mercy or his love are totally within it. If you're alive, you're within that mercy and within that love. So this sanctity is closest to that of the Creator. This is why it will have primacy over all other sanctities. Now, that's a very important thing. Here we are at the worst time in history, and yet this sanctity is being given to us, and Jesus is saying that it will be higher than all other sanctities, and that it will have primacy over all the other sanctities. Okay? Where sin abounds, St. Paul said that where sin abounds, grace doth even more abound. I think that's a very important statement. All I know is it's Paul's letter to the Romans, where it sounds like Romans chapter 3, where sin abounds, grace abounds even more. I just want to put that into ordinary English. Grace abounds even more. In other words, you see humanity going down into the depths of evil, and you see the Lord raising his saints up into the heights that are completely dizzy, even for the saints. This sanctity will enclose within itself all other sanctities. Now, this is from Jesus himself. It's not from us. This sanctity will enclose all other sanctities together and will be the life of all other sanctities. In other words, it's this relationship with God that's going to enable other people to have their dramatic miracle ministries and their wonderful evangelization ministries and all the other ministries that they have, and the great preachers. It will enable them to have their great ministry, and they won't have any idea that there are completely hidden souls upon the earth empowering that. Just as you might have a great cooker or a great washing machine or a great any other kind of machine, and you may not pay too much attention to the fact that it is the silent power of electricity coming very quietly through the wires that's enabling that to happen. So this hidden life is actually very important. It's the hidden life of Nazareth. It will enclose within itself all other sanctities together and will be the life of all other sanctities. What a grace it is for you who know it. Absolutely. Amen. For Louisa to be the first, like a solar ray, to come out from the centre of my sanctity without ever detaching from it. You see, those who have rebelled have detached from this divine sanctity to find disgrace and disintegration on the way. A greater grace I could not give you, Jesus said. A more portentous miracle I couldn't operate in you. In other words, this is it. This is God's highest and God's best. Be attentive, my daughter, my ray. Isn't that interesting? A ray from the divine. Because every time you enter into my will and operate in it, it happens, it's the same as when the sun hits the glass. Many suns are formed in it. In the same way, you repeat my life many times and you multiply it and you give new life to my love. And notice it is you give new life to my love. And so this is where the importance of our cooperation is. And it fascinates me that the Lord wants small creatures like us involved, that he wants us to participate. That fascinates me totally. Okay. So Louisa said, after this, she was thinking, in this holy will, one cannot see miracles and those portentous things for which creatures are so greedy. We love big signs and wonders, you know, and we think that someone's terribly important if they can preach a fantastic sermon or work a miracle. We're really greedy for that. We like drama. And people would go around half the world in order to see a miracle and a sign. And as we know, in our own day, promises of miracles and signs in different places has made millions of people get on airplanes and go to that shrine so that they can participate as well. Now, I'm going to throw some water on that. I remember speaking to someone who told me that he had seen the sun dance in Medjugorje. And as far as he was concerned, that was it. His whole trip was justified. I said, what did the miracle do for you? He said, what do you mean? I said, you saw the sun dance in the sky. You saw this big drama. You saw this great sign. What did it do for you? He said, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, listen, man, if God has given you a sign, if God has shown you one of his miracles, surely there is a response from you to God. That idea hadn't occurred to him. There was no thanksgiving. There was no commitment. There was no conversion. There was no running to the confessional to get rid of my old sins. I said, your journey wasn't justified. The miracle is lost on you. You appeared not to receive any grace. And so let me read this again. In this holy will, one cannot see miracles and those portentous things for which creatures are so greedy, and they would go around half the world in order to have them. On the contrary, everything in this spirituality passes between the soul and God. And if creatures receive good, they don't even know where it came from, because God comes in a hidden way to us. And you only know that this thing is there. It wasn't there before, and it's there now. It really is like the sun, which, though it gives life to all, nobody points to it. Now, as I was thinking of this, Jesus coming back added, but with an imposing appearance. What miracles? What miracles? Isn't it perhaps doing my will that is the greatest miracle of all? Now, I must tell you a little story. It'll make you smile. In a primary school, a class of little boys were doing the stories from the Old Testament. And they had read, and their teacher tried to explain that the sun stood still when Joshua prayed so that a battle could be completed in one day. Because if the sun went down, there was going to be no victory. So God, in his great mercy, held time still until the battle was finished. And so the children were asked a question. What was the greatest miracle in the Bible? And this story was fresh in a child's mind. And you know that children very often get the gist of what you're saying. And when they give you back what they remember, it's totally hilarious. And one little boy said, the greatest miracle in the Bible. Now, he never mentioned creation. He never mentioned the incarnation. And he never mentioned redemption. And he never mentioned Pentecost. Okay, now all of those things that happened. He said, the greatest miracle in the Bible was when a father told his son to stand still and he did it. I think that's brilliant. I think it's totally brilliant. Because the child said, doing the Father's will is the greatest miracle of all. And here's Jesus saying, living surrendered, totally surrendered in the divine will is the greatest miracle of all. Don't you agree? If you look at Micah 6:8, you will understand that the prophets in the Old Testament went to enormous trouble to try and tell people that God was simply asking them to do his will. He wasn't asking anything else. And so Micah said, this is what the Lord asks of you, only this, that you would act justly, that you would love tenderly, and that you would walk humbly with your God. How simple can it get? Would they do it? No. I don't know if you've ever done any babysitting. I did for a while until I was enlightened. And then I gave it up. Because invariably, when the mother would be walking out the front door, she'd say to the children, don't touch the biscuits. For the rest of the evening, there was no issue on the planet except biscuits. Why? Because there was a moratorium on them. Once there was a prohibition put on the biscuits, that was the issue. I must have what you don't want me to have. My will is against your will. And you found that even in the smallest of children. Don't touch the cake. Cake is the only issue. If the mother had said nothing, you might have had a nice evening. And it's don't touch the apple in the Garden of Eden. Once the prohibition was there, the rebellion came out. My will against yours. And that's why the Lord says that living surrendered to his will and allowing him to be God, not just out there in his own dimension, but right down here in the everydayness of our lives. Let him be God in every single movement, interiorly and exteriorly. He says that's the greatest miracle of all, and it's the greatest sacrifice. Because we've surrendered our autonomy. We've surrendered our me thing. And we've also surrendered all our greed and everything else that goes with it. That makes me want to glorify myself. And so Jesus said, isn't perhaps doing my will the greatest miracle? My will is eternal. And is the eternal miracle that never ends. It is the miracle of every instant in which the human will has a continuous connection with the divine will. So there's the total surrender. And really, we're not in the divine will in any serious way until this total surrender comes. Raising the dead, giving sight to the blind and the like are not eternal things. They're subject to perishing. And the problem is, you might give sight to the blind and that person may not turn to God. So it's an external sign that a person may or may not benefit from. We know that some of the people who cried for Jesus' death on Good Friday had received miracles from him. And he said, so these signs can be called shadows of miracles, fleeting miracles, compared to the great and permanent miracle of living in my will. So we really need to take note of this. You, Louisa, and you and me reading and listening to this should pay no attention to those miracles. And yet, if you go on YouTube, you'll find loads of examples of these type of dramatic miracles, and they think they've really reached the ultimate. They haven't. You should pay no attention to these miracles. I know when they are appropriate and when they are needed. There's a certain stage in people's lives when they need signs and wonders. It's a very early stage. A very early stage. So, November the 16th, 1921. Sin is the chain that binds man. And Jesus wanted to be bound in order to break these chains. This morning, my beloved Jesus made him seen all bound. His hands, his feet, his waist were bound. And a double iron chain was coming down from his neck. He was bound so tightly that his divine person was deprived of motion. What a harsh position, such as to make even the stones cry. And this is a perfect image of slavery to sin. Jesus had it on the outside to try and show us what slavery to sin on the inside is like. You have absolutely no freedom. You can't move one way or the other. So that's Romans 5:5. He was made into sin for us. So Jesus said, my daughter, during the course of my passion, all the other pains competed with each other, but they would alternate. One would give place to the other. Almost like sentries, they would mount guard to do the worst to me and to boast about having been better than the other. But the ropes were never taken away from me. From the very beginning, Jesus was bound. And I think this is an absolutely extraordinary thing that if you really look at it, Jesus came on earth to break all our bonds, to release us. And if you have in your mind at this moment the image of a zip, a long zip, and Jesus came to open that zip, to liberate us, to free us, absolutely. But as soon as we got our hands on him, we bound him. We bound him physically in ropes. We tried to bind him emotionally by torture, and we tried to bind him mentally by injustice. And we tried to bind him in every possible way. He was bound and bound and bound and bound and bound and bound and bound until we nailed him to the cross. That's what sin does. And what grace does is it breaks all the chains. And that's the glorious sign of the resurrection, that he unchained us. So So Jesus said, the ropes were never taken away from me from the moment I was taken up to Calvary. I remained always bound. Rather, they kept adding more and more ropes and chains for fear that I might escape and to make more mockery of me. In other words, it was like as if they were saying, break free of that. Let us see that you really are God. You know, you say you're the Son of God. Well, give us an idea of what that actually looks like. And so they brought that to its fullness on Calvary when they said, he saved others. He can't even save himself. Who do you think he is? But Jesus says how many pains, confusion, and humiliation, how much pain, let's put this into English, how much pain, confusion, and humiliation, and how many falls did these chains cause me, he said. Because, you mean, he could hardly move. And if you chain the legs, how are you going to be able to walk? However, know that in these chains, there was a great mystery and great expiation. As man begins to fall into sin, he remains bound with the chains of his own sin. If the sin is grave, they are iron chains. If it is venial, they are chains of rope. So, as he tries to walk in good, he feels the hindrance of these chains and his step remains hindered. This hindrance, he feels, wears him out, debilitates him and leads him to new falls. If he works, he feels hindrance in his hands and remains almost as if he had no hands to do good. In seeing him bound like this, passions make feast and they say, ah, the victory is ours. And from being the king, that means the dominator of your own body, soul and spirit. The person in control of their own little land. Instead of that, they render him a slave of brutal passions. How abominable man is in the state of sin. And I, in order to break these chains, wanted to be bound and never be without chains. You see, nothing happened in the passion that God didn't actually permit. And if God permitted it, it had a very good purpose. Because God won't permit something that doesn't have a good purpose. It's as simple as that. If Jesus wanted to be chained and roped the whole way through in the entire passion, it means that breaking human beings away from the chains of their passions and their bad habits and their wrong choices, that was going to be the hardest break. So he said, in order to break these chains, I wanted to be bound and never be without chains, so as to keep my chains ever ready to break his. And when the blows and the shoves made me fall, I stretched my hands towards him to untie him and make him free again. I mean, even that sentence is enough for a meditation. That here he falls as a result of not having control over his physical body because he's so chained and roped. And he said, in the fall, I reached out to the human race in its fall. I reached out to every human being in their falls. There's something beautiful, magnificent about that. And as he was saying this, Louisa said, I saw almost all people bound in chains in such a way as to arouse pity. And I prayed Jesus to touch their chains with his chains so that at the touch of his chains, those of the creatures would be shattered. So Louisa suddenly realizes that all human beings are chained in some way unless they have broken through to real sanctity. And the chains of good people are much sadder than the chains of bad people. And in fact, it's much easier to break the chains of bad people than to break the chains of good people. The reason for that is that the sins of the bad people are obvious. Everybody can see them, you know. I've often visited people in maximum security prisons. Maybe I shouldn't say often, but I have sometimes done it. They're in prison, convicted of some awful crime, and they're paying for it by this incarceration. Everybody sees the sin, they're convicted, and they eventually have to see it themselves. So much easier to talk to them. I found it so much easier to evangelize them than to evangelize good people in a church. Because the good people in the church think they're fine. And very often their sins are hidden. They're not only hidden from the people around them, but they hide them from themselves as well. And it's much, much harder to reach them. And if you try and challenge them, oh, they can really get upset and you're the one that's at fault. Whereas you won't upset the prisoner in the jail. I remember speaking to a crowd of men who had 40-year sentences, approximately. And I told them that I wanted to show them how to get freedom. They said, "You mean get out of the jail?" And I said, "No. There's people outside and they're just as jailed as you are. They just think they're free." I said, "Real freedom is inside in yourself." And immediately they began to be interested. And I began to talk to them about forgiveness, that forgiveness is the key to heaven. And I said, forgiveness is the key to be released from the chains that brought you in here. Because it was chains that brought you in here. I got a most marvelous response from them. And the sheer numbers that went to confession were unbelievable. The priest who was looking after the prison told me he had never been so busy. Now, I've only given you a taste of that encounter. But for me, it was very precious. And I've often spoken in churches and wondered, is there anybody listening? Is there anybody here who would acknowledge that they've got chains? So it's much harder to speak to good people than to the so-called bad people. So let's look at November the 19th, 1921, the two supports of Jesus in Gethsemane. Louisa said, "I was keeping company with my Jesus who was agonizing in the Garden of Gethsemane. And as much as I could, I sympathized with him. I pressed him tightly to my heart, hoping, trying to wipe away his mortal sweats. And my sorrowful Jesus, with faint and expiring voice, said, 'My daughter, my agony in the garden was hard and painful, maybe more painful than that of the cross.' Isn't that extraordinary? That's because it was interior. That was because it was interior. And it was at the end of this agony. You'll find this particularly in St. Mark's Gospel. When I say particularly, I mean more dramatically in Mark's Gospel. That when Jesus came out of the agony, he said to the apostles, "It's all over." And yet, as far as everybody's concerned, the passion is only beginning. But as far as he was concerned, it was all over, because he had now worked his way through this agony to total surrender. And once he had surrendered, the rest was just fallout. So he said, "The agony in the garden was hard and painful, maybe more painful than that of the cross. In fact, if the cross was the fulfillment and the triumph over all, here in the garden, it was the beginning. And sufferings are felt more at the beginning than when they are reaching their climax." That's interesting. But in this agony, the most harrowing pain was that all sins came before me one by one. That's the horrendous part of it, one by one. My humanity understood all their enormity, and each crime carried the mark death to God, armed with sword to kill me. In other words, Jesus knew that the only way he could release people from these sins was to die for them. Before the divinity, sin appeared to me as so very horrifying and more horrible than death itself. So I want to give you Habakkuk 1:13. Lord, your eyes are too holy to look upon sin. And also Hebrews 12:14. Without holiness, no one will ever see God. Before the divinity, sin appeared to me as so very horrifying and more horrible than death itself. Just as in understanding what sin means, I felt I was dying. And I did really die, he said. That's very interesting. I did really die. I cried out to the Father, but he was inexorable. Not even one was there to help me, so as not to let me die. I cried out to all creatures to have pity on me, but in vain. So my humanity languished, and I was about to receive the last death blow. This is where he sweated agony on the cross. But do you know who prevented me? But do you know who prevented the execution and sustained my humanity from dying? It was my inseparable mother. That's the beautiful thing. In hearing me ask for help, because you know our Blessed Lady was spiritually completely at one with Jesus, and she knew spiritually what was happening to him. In hearing me ask for help, she flew to my side, that is spiritually, not physically. Or as we would say, she bilocated to be beside him. She flew to my side, she sustained me, and I leaned my right arm on her. Almost dying, I looked at her and I found in her the immensity of my will intact. There was one human being in the whole of history that the divine will was completely intact, never ever denied, without ever a break between my will and hers. My will is life. And since the will of the Father was immovable and death was coming to me from creatures, another creature who enclosed the life of my will gave me life. And there is my mother who, in the portent of my will, conceived me and gave me birth in time, now giving me life for the second time. Now, this is something that is unknown to everybody. This is a revelation straight from Jesus himself. We could not possibly have known this unless he said it. She was giving me life for a second time to let me accomplish the work of redemption. So there's Our Lady as the co-redeemer. It's really fantastic. Then I looked to my left and I found the little daughter of my will. Because we've been told just in the last couple of messages that if you end up surrendering to the divine will and living 24/7, 365 in the divine will, totally surrendered to him, that you have been called from all eternity. And as far as he was concerned, the moment you would enter in, you were part of everything past, present and future. So you were there. So I want to give you Matthew 20, verses 20 to 23. And so he says to Louisa, I found the little daughter of my will there as well. I found you as the first, that is, the first of all those who would live in the divine will who had been born with original sin, followed by the other daughters of my will, that's you and me. Since I wanted my mother with me as the first link of mercy through which we were to open the doors of mercy to all creatures, I wanted to lean my right arm on her. And I wanted you as the first link of justice to prevent it from unloading itself on creatures as they deserve. Therefore, I wanted to lean my left arm on you so that you might sustain it together with me. Now, what I want to do is give you Exodus chapter 17, verses 8 to 16. This is where Moses was on a little hill interceding for the people of God. And he had Aaron on his right hand and Hur on the left. Now, Aaron was the first high priest and Hur was the chief among the laity, the priesthood and the laity supporting him. And if the arms flagged, the battle went against them. If the arms were held, raised until evening, then they won the battle. And here you have Jesus, the new Moses, and he's leaning on his mother's right arm, the mother of all priests, the one who anticipated the priesthood. And you've got Louisa representing all the laity on the left. Now, do you remember that in the gospel, towards the end of it, James and John had their mother ask Jesus, could they be on his right and left in the kingdom? And Jesus told them that while they would participate in the passion, that the places right and left were for the ones whom the Father had designated. Nobody would have guessed that it was two women. That his mother was on his right hand and Louisa on the left. As he went through that agony in which he decided to be the Redeemer for us. Isn't this incredible? With these two supports, I felt life coming back to me, he said. And as if I had not suffered anything, with firm step, I went to meet my enemies. Now, Louisa describes this marvellously in the Hours of the Passion, where he recovers to the point where when he goes to meet the men who arrest him, he has got his strength back. And he's able to take all the other torture that comes after it and still not die before the time. It's an incredible amount of strength that was given to him. Absolutely amazing. So look at what he said there, that he was reborn a second time through his mother. So I don't think we have realised just to what extent our Blessed Mother was involved in the passion, death and resurrection of Jesus. So with these two supports, he said, I felt life come back to me. And as if I had not suffered anything, with firm step, I went to meet my enemies. In all the pains that I suffered during my passion, many of which were capable of giving me death, these two supports, that is, our Blessed Mother and Louisa, never left me. And you can see that in the Hours of the Passion. Louisa goes through it step by step with him. And she intercedes for him and with him and in him and through him. It's just totally amazing. And when they saw me nearly dying with my own will, which they contained, they sustained me, and though, as though giving me many sips of life. O prodigies of my will, Jesus said, who can ever count them and calculate their value? This is why I love so much the one who lives in my will. I recognize my portrait in her. I recognize my own noble features. I feel my own breath, my own voice. And if I did not love her, I would defraud myself. I would be like a father without offspring, without the noble cortege of his court, and without the crown of his children. And if I did not have the offspring, the court and the crown, how could I call myself a king? My kingdom, Jesus said, is formed by those who live in my will. And from this kingdom, I choose the mother, the queen, the children, the ministers, the army, the people. I am everything for them, and they are everything for me. So notice what an important role the Lord has actually given to us, that the kingdom is going to come on earth through us, because it'll only come through those who live in the divine will. So afterwards, Louisa said, I was thinking about what Jesus had told me, and I said to myself, how can this be put into practice? And Jesus said, in order to know the truths, it is necessary to have the will and the desire to know them. So I want you to put a big heading here, desire to know the truths. If you really want to know the truths, he will reveal them. You could be reading Louise's material and you don't really want the revelations. Well, the material will just die on you. You'll find it going over your head. Imagine a room, Jesus said, in which the shutters are closed. No matter how much sun there is outside, the room remains in the dark. But opening the shutters means that you want the light. But this is not enough if you don't take advantage of the light to reorder the room and dust it and put yourself to work so as not to kill the light that has been given and become ungrateful. In other words, light is a gift. We must use it. So that's why people work in daylight. In the same way, it's not enough to have the will to know the truths. If at the light of the truth which illuminates him, one does not try to dust himself down of his own weaknesses, reorder himself according to the light of the truth he knows, and put himself to work together with the light of the truth, making of it his own substance. Now there you have James chapter 1 verses 22 to 25. It's not enough, James told us, to read the word of God and walk off. It's not enough to listen to the word of God proclaimed at Mass and then walk off. It's crazy stuff. You've got to hear the word of God. You've got to let it take root in us, and it must actually produce its fruit. And so Jesus is saying here, with the enlightenment that's given to us in these divine will writings, if we don't take them on board, if we don't internalize them, if we don't allow them to take root, and if we don't allow our lives to be reordered with them, what's the point? It's a waste of our time and an insult to God. It would be as if you killed the truth, Jesus said. And by not putting it into practice, it would be like remaining in total disorder in the light. The poor room full of light and it's all messy, upside down and total disorder. With a person in it who does not take the care of reordering it. How pitiful is that? Such is the one who knows the truths and doesn't put them into practice. However, know that simplicity enters into all truths as the first nourishment. Now, here you have something very, very important. If someone coming to these truths is coming with the complexity of worldliness, they don't stand a chance. Nothing here will make any sense. But if we have been trying to internalize what the Lord has been teaching us, there is an enormous simplicity in the heart of the whole thing. But we're not even going to see that unless our lives are being simplified. And so we've got to throw away the complexities of the world. If the truths were not simple, Jesus said, they would not be light, as in the light of the sun or the enlightenment of grace. He doesn't mean light as lightweight. If the truths were not simple, they would not be light, and they could not penetrate into human minds to enlighten them. And where there's no light, objects cannot be distinguished. Simplicity is not only light, but it is like the air that one breathes, which though it cannot be seen, gives respiration to everyone. And if it wasn't for the air, the earth and everyone in it would remain without motion. Therefore, if the virtues, the truths, do not carry the mark of simplicity, they will be without light and without air. Now, God is light. And we're told that simplicity is light. So in this entire process, we have to be transformed into light in order to come to that singularity, to that place where we are completely submerged, totally abandoned in the divine will. I'm going to stop there for a moment.